Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is United States against Caputo. Mr. Rosenthal.
Good morning, and may it please the Court, my name is Sam Rosenthal. I represent Mr. Riley, the appellant in this case. I'd like to start with an issue which is very narrow but has a broad reach, and that is whether truthful, non-misleading information can be not only prohibited but criminalized under the guise of prohibiting off-label use. The reason I say...
I would hope that you will address the question whether that question is presented, since the jury was told it could convict your client only if it was found he committed fraud.
That's absolutely incorrect, most respectfully. What the jury was told was this was a multi-object conspiracy. In paragraph 3A, there was off-label use. In paragraph 3B, there was an adulterated device. The instruction which governed how the jury viewed this case appears at page 164, where the jury was told the manufacturer is not permitted to promote uses for a device that have not been cleared by the FDA. Nothing about fraud. If there's off-label use, you can convict.
That's a different question. If I understand the argument about off-label use, it is that the First Amendment creates a right to advertise a device that may lawfully be sold for a particular use. But it does seem that in order to convict your client, the jury had to find either fraud or the device couldn't be sold at all for any use. And that rather removes the basis for an argument about promoting for a lawful use.
What the jury was instructed was it had to find one of the two objects. That instruction appears in the record. And if the jury is told it had to convict if it found an object or one object, and one of those objects was simply off-label use, it didn't have to find fraud.
Let me ask it in still a different way. Was it possible for the jury to convict if the only thing it concluded was that the defendants had promoted the off-label use of a device that was properly registered and approved by the FDA for sale?
The jury could have convicted if they found that there was nothing more than off-label use. The jury could have convicted
of a device that was properly sold in the United States.
Well, since the government presented it in the alternative, the jury was presented with that alternative. It had the choice of finding either this was a device.
Counsel, listen to my question. Under the jury instructions, if the jury believed that there was no fraud and that the device was properly sold in the United States, could it have convicted?
Absolutely.
All right. Now, show me how under the jury instructions that could have happened.
It could have happened when the jury was told defendant must be found to have agreed with another person to accomplish an illegal objective. That instruction, which appears at page 166, tells the jury, go look at the two objectives. One of them had nothing to do with fraud. One of them had nothing to do with whether or not this device was approved. And that's
But as you said, there are two objectives. One was fraud and one was the sale of an unlawful device.
Actually, Your Honor, one was the sale of an adulterated device, which was an unapproved device, and the other was off-label use. The notion of fraud was that you had deceived the FDA by doing both of those things. The argument that there was lying, the argument that there was cheating, was simply a part, and it's described exactly that way in the indictment, a part of the conspiracy. And so the jury could have found there was no lying, there was no misrepresentation, but there was a sale of an adulterated device as charged in 3B. There was the off-label use as charged in 3A. And the district court said, if you find either of those, go and convict. And so the question really is presented, and it's presented not just in the jury instructions. Even if the instructions had steered clear of this, it's also presented by the way the prosecutor opened and closed. I count 27 times in the opening statement alone the prosecutor said, go and look and see whether there's off-label use. The prosecutor's statement was not convict only if you find that the defendants had lied about whether they were off-label using, off-label selling, or off-label marketing.
One reason why I have difficulty with thinking that this issue is presented is that, as far as I can see, what the prosecutor was arguing was that your client was lying to the FDA about whether it was promoting off-label use. And that could be a crime even if it was perfectly fine to promote off-label use. provided you didn't lie to the FDA about whether you were doing that.
If that were true, they would not have identified exactly that position as only a, quote, part of the conspiracy. They would have identified that as the conspiracy. They didn't. And
I'm lost. If the prosecutor thinks that somebody has done two or three unlawful things, why do they have to charge only one?
If they give the jury alternatives and they say to the jury, you can convict if it's one, two, or three, which is exactly what they did here, then the issue is presented if you can't tell the basis on which the jury convicted. That's exactly the situation in Stromberg. It's exactly the situation here. While the prosecutor did, in fact, argue that the defendants had lied to the FDA about whether they were off-label using, off-label promoting, if the jury was told, you don't have to find that lie.
Could you... Maybe I'm just repeating myself, but I'm trying to figure out whether it is possible under the instructions to convict your client if the jury has believed that everything they told the FDA was true and they had every lawful right to sell the 5-cubic-foot device.
The answer again is yes, because...
Is there anything in the instruction you point me to other than this thing at page 166?
Well... If you, in the pre-trial instruction at page 38, the judge said in very...
I don't care what the judge said. I care what the jury instructions said.
And that is the jury instruction I'm referring to.
Just
at page 38, the manufacturer is not permitted to promote uses that have not been cleared by the FDA. Nothing about lying. Nothing about a device being cleared. It was, you can't sell it if it's not been cleared by the FDA. These uses are commonly...
You're not listening to my question. Is it possible for the jury to convict if it found that the defendants were authorized to sell this device?
The answer is yes, because half the witnesses testified about simply the marketing of the device. It was the marketing of the device and nothing more that was a standalone crime.
Every time I ask about the jury instructions, you answer about what the prosecutor argued or what a witness testified.
No, Your Honor. I'm inviting your attention to a pretrial instruction that appears on page 38 and a post-trial instruction that appears in the appendix at 166. In both cases, the jury is told, and the prosecutor takes and runs with it, you can convict. It is illegal to market a device off-label. Period. Full stop. That's the crime.
All right. Now, where in the instruction at 166 does the judge say that?
That the defendant must be found to have agreed with another person to accomplish an illegal objective. That's referring to 3A. 3A is off-label marketing. Nothing to do with lying, nothing to do with an adulterated device.
What do you mean that's 3A?
You're using some kind of code. I'm sorry, paragraph 3A of the indictment.
And what does that say?
That was one of the two objects, which was the promotion of an off-label device. And because that object, which is found in paragraph 3A of the indictment, says nothing about lying to the FDA about it, it says nothing about sale of an adulterated device, the jury was told, if you find that object to be satisfied, you can convict. And I see my remaining time I'd like to reserve for rebuttal unless the court has questions.
Mm-hmm. Certainly.
Thank you.
Mr. Martin.
May it please the court, thank you. At the close of the case, the district court refused a series of defense submitted instructions. Those instructions are in our supplemental appendix. The instructions were correct statements of law. They were not covered elsewhere in the final instructions.
Which instructions are you referring to?
I'm referring to the... they're entitled Modified Government Instruction 21.
No. Look, I don't have a catalog by number. Just describe the instruction.
Once a device has received 510 clearance, a manufacturer is not required.
Don't read it. Describe it.
It is the instruction which paraphrases 21 CFR 807.81, and it talks about...
So if I knew exactly what verbatim that was, I'd be fine.
It appears at Joint Appendix page 123, and what this instruction said that... It talked about when 510Ks are supposed to be submitted. That's what the instruction talked about. And it talked about that not every modification or change to a device required a new 510K, only those changes which significantly affect the safety or the effectiveness of the device is where a new 510K is required. That was the substance of the instruction. The second instruction referred to guidance, and the guidance played an important role in this trial. The problem with the guidance is that it's just that, it's guidance. It does not have the force of law. It's not binding upon the manufacturer. An instruction which was...
Were there other instructions regarding 510K?
There was an instruction regarding 510K, and the way it occurred is at the beginning of the case, the judge decided because it was a complex case, he was going to give instructions on the regulations before opening statements, actually. And he gave an instruction on 510K, which is the instruction I'm talking about, which he refused at the end of the case, which is the one about when a new 510K is required. At the end of the case, he gave a 510K instruction in which he required the in commercial distribution aspect to be an element of the instruction. And that was an element that was subject to some debate. What happened was this. Prior to trial, the judge originally ruled that the defense would not be entitled to submit a good faith instruction based on his interpretation of this regulation. The defense then presented an affidavit from a former FDA official that talked about the FDA never gave literal interpretation to the in-commercial distribution requirement. The government presented a letter to the judge in which FDA chief counsel said that an interpretation would be coming in due course, but it would probably indicate that we have not given literal interpretation to it. So we start off the case without the in-commercial distribution aspect in the case, and we finish it with it in it. So there was a change there, and that element was injected into the case at the end. The government seized upon this in its closing arguments. It argued that a 510K was required because the device was not in commercial distribution, even though the FDA had not interpreted it that way, even though the court's preliminary instructions had not injected that element into the case.
Can I ask you a question? If you just get away from all these instructions and 510Ks and all that. Somewhere, Judge Castile, in one of these six or seven opinions that he wrote in this case, describe what was going on here as essentially a bait and switch, that the defendants were getting clearance, FDA approval, to market this small sterilizer, but that wasn't really what they were after. There was no market for that, and then they were substituting this large sterilizer for it. Is that essentially a fair characterization of what the defendants were doing factually here?
That's a fair characterization of the government's theory, and of course...
I want to know if you think that's fair characterization of the evidence, and that's what the defendants were doing.
A bait and switch?
Yeah.
No, because when you look at the regulation, it talks
about... Why not? I mean, there was no market for selling the small sterilizer to hospitals, wasn't there?
Because the question is whether the changes that occurred here were changes in chamber size and changes to the percentage of the solution, right, for lack of a better word. And if you look at, and I hate to get back to the jury instructions or the regulations, but if you...
Well, that's why I want you to stay away from this.
Right. The issue...
Make me feel better.
The FDA...
I want to just know what was going on here and if that's a fair characterization of what was going on.
From the defendant's perspective, the FDA left it to the manufacturer to determine whether the changes significantly impacted safety or effectiveness. And that's the way that regulation has been interpreted.
Well, we know it affected safety because there were a lot of people that had the eye surgeries and problems with their corneas after it.
What's interesting to note is that the original data in 1991 that was submitted for the cleared device noted the occurrence of the blue-green residue. And that was what was proved. Now, the question is...
Didn't one of the salesmen then go and run out and go to a payphone to make a call and say, holy man, we got a problem here?
There was a salesman named Sarnes who was at Ravenswood Hospital where some of these occurred, and he observed the blue-green residue on the instruments, and he went out and he called Mr. Riley. That is true. that he saw that. Abtox did do things to investigate it. Of course, in hindsight, the government is saying that wasn't good enough. But the CDC did an investigation here, and they couldn't find, at least during the relevant time period, a causation. And the question is, was the modification to the sterilizer, the change from 1 to 5 feet, is that what caused these injuries? Well, if you apply the industry standards, a change of this nature was not substantial. If you apply the literal meaning of the 93 guidance, then any change was. And this gets back to my instruction point. This is why we were seeking an instruction on the guidance, that they didn't have the force of law.
How much... How widely did they market the small version?
Why didn't they market it?
How widely was it marketed?
Did they sell a lot of them, or a few of them?
Your Honor, they sold none of them. It was not marketed. It was not sold.
But that goes back to Judge Evans' bait and switch thing. They knew they weren't going to be able to market it. I think there was some reference that would only sterilize knives and forks or something.
Flat stainless steel instruments. From the defendant's perspective, once they had the clearance on the small device, they could implement changes to it. And this was their defense, which, of course, for the jury to evaluate, we need the instructions, because there's a question of, well, do the regulations allow changes to a device that's been cleared? The guidance seems to say that if literally any change to the chamber size requires a new 510K, but is that in fact the way it's been interpreted by the industry? Is that in fact guidance have the force of law?
So this is, actually the small one is a prototype from which the larger one was developed.
That would be a fair statement. And there were changes to the chamber size and the number of bottles and the percentage of the solution. This case, I would respectfully submit, required more than just a general good faith instructions which were given. In order for the government to understand the regulatory provisions that were issued and to have a perspective of the regulatory provisions that were issued, those provisions needed some law. And while the law came at the beginning of the case, it did not come at the end of the case. And I know the government will argue, well, Mr. Caputo and Mr. Riley got their instructions at the beginning of the case, so it's harmless error or something to that effect. But at the beginning,
you could have argued that to the jury, though, could you not? Those instructions, those preliminary instructions were given.
Well, the in commercial distribution instruction, no, we couldn't, because that changed. So that one couldn't be argued. And could the defense lawyer have argued the? Well, remember. 8 weeks ago, the judge read you something. I suppose he could, but the instructions that were given at the beginning of the case were not in writing. They were given at a time when the jury had no knowledge of any of this, and they were also conditional. They were qualified. The judge says, wait to the end of the case, because that's when you're going to get the controlling instructions. I would note with respect to expert opinions, and this gets to the issue of prejudice, the district court ruled before trial that the defense experts could not specifically opine that Abtox had clearance to market the sterilizer, that they could continue to market the sterilizer, and even ruled that they couldn't opine about the effect of the guidance documents. And the court ruled that the defense would have to rule on the jury instructions, which did not come at the end of the case. This same rule did not apply to government witnesses. Tim Ulatowski, who was the FDA point person or supervisor in the Office of Device Compliance, was asked, pursuant to an overruled objection, the ultimate question, the defendants have a good faith reason whatsoever to continue marketing the sterilizer? He answered no, they had no business doing that. Again, over objection, Ulatowski testified to ultimate issues about promotion, objected to, and about whether the device was misbranded or adulterated. And that one there was no objection to. I see I'm into my rebuttal time, but I do want to just make one point about the juror issue before I sit down. Last week, we submitted a 28-J letter based on the Warner-Ryan case. And at first blush, you might read Warner-Ryan and say, hey, you know what? It's up to the jury's, up to the judge's discretion, and it's lights out for the issue. But if you closely read Warner-Ryan, if you look at the three jurors that were excused for cause with the approval of the majority opinion in the court, their records, I would submit, were even less serious than Tim Ryan's. The court held
it. Counsel, I didn't see in your brief an argument that had these convictions been disclosed, the district judge would have been required to excuse this juror for cause.
Well, I do think we argued that, Your Honor, because we argued that if you applied the McDonough standard in the first prong of the McDonough standard, there should be excusal for cause. The hearing that the court held, before the hearing, he told the juror, you don't need a lawyer. The man was going to admit to felony conduct. Why he didn't need a lawyer is I don't know. Counsel was not allowed to question him. The law recognizes that questioning by counsel is the best way to uncover bias. A juror's statements about his own bias have to be taken with a grain of salt. And the district court immediately ruled. I would suggest to this court that when you have a jury foreman in a false statement case, in a fraud case, who himself has forgery and false statement backgrounds, he should not be sitting on a jury. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Mr. Ferguson.
May it please the court. I'll take much less than my 25 minutes unless the court has specific questions, and I simply wish to respond this morning to the issues raised by counsel, as well as any other questions the court has. It is essentially, as to the first issue, it is the position of the United States that though issues regarding commercial speech may be presented in other cases, they are not in this case, because the remaining elements of the...
Well, as you heard in my discussion with Mr. Rosenthal, I was principally interested in the question whether it is possible on these instructions for the jury to have convicted if it found that there was no lies to the FDA and that that the defendants were authorized to sell the 5-cubic-foot device.
No.
And Mr. Rosenthal said yes. You say no. What's your basis in the jury instructions for saying no?
As Mr. Rosenthal noted, element one was that the defendants had to agree to commit an illegal objective, but the elements instruction went on. They also had to decide, in accordance with Hammerschmidt versus United States, that...
Don't look.
No.
The jurors haven't read Hammerschmidt against the United States. Just parse the jury instructions and... Right?
I'm simply noting its consistency with the controlling law. The second element, Your Honor, was that the defendants had to have intent to defraud the FDA or to impede or impair its lawful functions. The third element was that they had to do so by means of deceit, trickery, or overreaching, or... I've forgotten the fourth description. Essentially, misrepresentation. The fourth was, of course, the overt act. So... It is without, in fact, deceit, misrepresentation, and intent to defraud, they could not have been found guilty if the jury followed the instructions. They could not have been found guilty of count one. I hope that answers the court's question, and I think that the second and third elements...
Are you telling me that it was not possible to convict the defendants if the jurors believed that they were selling an unauthorized device but telling the truth to the FDA?
If the defendants
believe...
As I think
you just told me, that the jury had to find fraud in order to convict.
Of count one, it most certainly did. That was one of the elements of the offense. It had to find fraudulent intent, and it had to find deceit, trickery, or misrepresentation, and that was that language was, again, out of the Supreme Court case I cited. So if the defendants had honestly believed that this was an authorized device, that they had or a cleared device, and they had not, in fact, misrepresented what they were doing. For instance, they had simply disregarded the efforts of the FDA to tell them to stop and had simply gone ahead in an open and above-board way. They would not have been guilty of a Klein-type conspiracy, though they would still obviously have been guilty of selling the uncleared sterilizer to the...
Did they tell the FDA that they weren't selling the 5-cubic-foot?
Yes, Your Honor. They told... Oh, the 5-cubic-foot? No, They did not tell them that. What they told them was that they told them that they initially, in the first 510K that they submitted post-clearance, that they had made what they described as minor modifications to the device, which are in a non-obvious place described in a general way. Later, they submitted a 510K the following year, 1996, which specified the changes, proposed changes. Did not actually say that they were selling it with that with those changes made, but did describe the changes that they were seeking clearance for. When that was rejected, they filed an additional 510K asking for clearance for what they described as the changes. But I think, Your Honor, this comes back to, I think, one of the questions that was that you had asked earlier, and that was a question of whether or not this so-called small unit was a prototype for the large unit. In fact, I have to take issue with counsel's description of that. It was not. The large unit, where the 5-cubic-foot unit, was offered for sale in Canada as early as the latter part of 1993 and was actually being sold in Canada during the early part of 1994. The small unit, the so-called prototype, was cleared by the FDA in December of 1994. In other words, they were up and running. They are in production with a marketable unit in Canada. There's no reason that that couldn't have been submitted to the FDA as the device for clearance. But, in fact, it wasn't. They used definitely concealed the fact that they were intending to market the large one.
Why was that so? What's the difference?
The difference, I suspect, Your Honor, that the difference was that they knew they didn't have the data to support the large sterilizer. There are some important engineering differences between the large and the small sterilizer, and each of them had to be supported with data. To take a single example, Your Honor, the fact that the sterilization chamber had been increased 5 to 6 times in size raises important issues as to, for instance, the dispersal of the sterilant throughout the chamber. Is it dispersed evenly throughout the chamber? It raises issues because a larger chamber will have a larger load. It raises additional issues of load penetration. Will it penetrate throughout the load? All of these so-called changes, and they aren't really changes or differences because this is a pre-existing sterilizer, all of these had to be supported with data. And the defendants, in fact, tried to do that. They tried in their May of 1996 submission, and they tried again in their July of 1996 submission, and for that matter, they tried again in February of 1998 as the fraud was drawing to a close. And in each time, the FDA found that the data were insufficient to support their claims. So I'd have to say, Your Honor, that there seemed to be irrational reasons for doing this.
Documented problems with the 5-cubic-foot unit have to do with the difference in chamber size?
What did they have to do? The documented problems?
Yes.
Are you referring to the eye injuries, Your Honor?
Well,
the eye injury, I don't know that we can establish that the change in chamber size by itself led to the eye injuries or contributed to them. There were other changes, however, to the device which we think are more closely allied to the eye injuries. I chose the chamber size as the most obvious and as an example. First, and most dramatically, the change in intended use of the device was directly linked to the eye injuries. One of the things this
I take it the answer to my question is no.
As to the change in chamber size,
right.
We can't say that, Judge. We don't know, and we don't have data to say.
Well,
so we're not claiming
that.
You
can answer yes or no to the question whether any of the documented issues are attributed to the chamber size.
I can say
the eye problem, so far as I can tell, is caused by a chemical reaction between the sterilant and the components of some of the instruments that were used. That has to do with off-label use. It's utterly unrelated to chamber size.
Oh,
is there
right.
any other issue that's related to chamber size?
Not the chamber size, it's in terms of the demonstrated injuries. No, Judge, if that answers your question. However, there were also, among the other changes to the device itself, were an increase in the temperature and a change in the sterilant. One of the change in the sterilant, when the parasitic
concentration of the sterilant.
Change in the, well, that's true, Your Honor.
10% solution to a 5% solution.
That's correct, which had the effect of increasing the hydrogen peroxide concentration in the sterilant that was infused into the chamber. One of the things that this did is it made the sterilant more oxidizing, as defendant's own expert Whitaker conceded on cross-examination. that with the higher temperature chamber could have furthered or speeded up the oxidation of the instruments, which was, as Judge Easterbrook obviously notes incorrectly, was a function of the reaction of the sterilant with the brass in brass instruments. So the actual physical changes to the sterilizer, albeit not necessarily the change in state or chamber size, do in fact play a role, or arguably play a role, in the eye injuries that occurred.
What was the reason to change the sterilant? The concentration.
As I understand the reason, Judge, the sterilant was changed because the 5% sterilant was commercially available in a single bottle, and it was less trouble to put in a single bottle. Now, what the defendants told the FDA when they applied for the clearance for the small unit was that they were going to use a two-bottle system, which would be mixed each time, a diluent plus the sterilant, by the operator, and they would that would then produce a 10% peracetic acid solution. The reason for that, and the reason the FDA was concerned about that, was because it was the mixing was for a single use. By having concealed the fact that they were going to use a 5% bottle, put it in, the defendants were able to avoid giving the FDA what it actually had asked for and what it wanted, evidence on the stability of the sterilant in the chamber once it had been used and was retained in the reservoir for a second use. They never were able to come up with that information, and they went way out of their way to disguise this fact, this change in sterilant, to the FDA. At one point just before clearance, Your Honor, the defendant submitted, obviously by accident, language from the owner's manual or the operator's manual for the device they're selling in Canada, which referred to a single-use, single bottle. In fact, when the FDA pointed that out to him, said, what's up with this, they changed the language, went back to the two-bottle mixing, and they honed out over the next few days, honed out the precise wording of the description of how you mix the sterilants to the FDA, knowing full well that they were never on this earth going to offer for sale a sterilizer had a two-bottle system and a single use of the sterilant. And when I say that, I want to emphasize. Yes, Judge.
Why did the FDA approve the one cubic foot model? If I understand what the parties are saying correctly, it had no conceivable market for the approved use, being thoroughly thumped by a simple autoclave. Because for sterilizing stainless steel instruments, no one would spend the money for this model and the sterilant when you could sterilize them with water at high pressure.
That's correct, and all the witnesses emphasize that, Your Honor.
If somebody proposes a $1,000 solution to do something that the market is doing for $100, one would think the FDA would draw the conclusion that this is not what it appears.
The FDA doesn't, at least in this determination, make a decision as to whether this is going to be economically feasible.
No, you're not. Look, my question is, doesn't the FDA draw the inference that since no sane person would buy the thing that is being offered for approval, it must actually, they're going to sell it for something else?
Susanna Barrett, the reviewer, noted this, Judge, and she wondered what on earth they were going to do with such a device. However, under the system in which a 510K can be cleared if a subsequently submitted device is substantially equivalent to one which is legally marketed, either because it is not irrational, and it was originally the business plan of Abtox, in fact, to submit a small unit to establish the technology for the FDA and use this as a predicate device for subsequent 510Ks. This was new technology, this gas plasma. The FDA was not very much familiar with it. The market was not much familiar with it. And there was, in fact, an existing market need for something like this, a low-temperature sterilizer other than ethylene oxide. The business plans that Abtox submitted, which were to their investors, which were admitted in evidence in the government's case, all set this out as the objective, to gain acceptance by the FDA for this new technology, later to follow up with a 510K for what they described in their business plans as a marketable unit. They never did that. They got their 510K.
Well, but that goes back to the sort of prototype theory, though, right? I mean, that's what they're saying.
That was, yes, that was in fact the original theory, and that would be a true prototype, Your Honor. Or perhaps not a prototype, but I think a predicate device would be the relevant language in the law.
What happened to the device in the 5-cubic foot device in Canada?
There were recurring – first, it was marketed for quite a while. There were recurring issues with the blue-green residue, and that was something that one time some of the company – senior employees were summoned up to Vancouver, I believe somewhere in British Columbia, to see these all these blue-green residue issues, or blue-green residue instruments laid out and given a very hard time about it, as they should have been. We're not aware of any actual injuries.
The injuries here, though, were there ever any civil products liability lawsuits that were brought against EBCA?
To my knowledge, no, nor were there, even more surprisingly, any brought against the hospitals, Your Honor. The VA hospitals were not sued by any of the veterans. The Missouri Baptist Hospital, which might have been, seemed to have been well exposed, offered free medical care, basically, to all the surviving patients. Most of these were cataract patients, Your Honor. They are mostly, though not in all cases, rather elderly, as an elderly cohort, as cataract patients, as you would expect. You know, some of them have passed away. Some are still alive, but still suffering the ill effects of their encounter with the Avtox sterilizer. If there are no other questions from the court, I would like to move on just briefly to say that the government does not believe that this case is in any way similar to the factual basis in the Ryan case with regard to the juror. In the Ryan case, the judge made a finding of fact that the jurors had lied. The underlying events were believed to be constitute a basis for a challenge for cause. In this case, Judge Caputo, who not only had a chance to observe the juror over the course of 9 weeks, but sat a lot closer to him across the table than I am to Your Honors at this moment, made a factual finding, which is well supported by logic and in the record, that the defendant, or that the juror, had made a good faith mistake. That really precludes any analysis of the second Greenwood, the Greenwood prong, though in that case, again, there would have been no basis for a challenge.
When did that New York or the USA Today article come out with regard to that juror? Was it while the case was still being tried?
No, it was I think about June. The case was over in April, Judge. Don't hold me the exact date, but a month, 2 months after the jury. And, of course, the judge at one of the things the judge asked the juror at the hearing, which he did ask questions submitted by the parties, was, were you embarrassed about this? Is that he gave him, offered him basically sort of a soft landing here. Were you embarrassed about and to bring these up? And the juror pointed out, I think not unreasonably, I just put my face on the cover of USA Today, the country's best-selling newspaper. I told them my life story. I'm not embarrassed about anything. I take responsibility for what I've done. That was that fact, as well as others, adequately supports the court's factual finding, and I think the court should respect that. If there are no other questions, I'm done. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm. We have some time remaining. Mr. Rosenthal, anything further?
Yes, thank you. I'd just like to point out that there was a mention of Mr. Sarnes. There were two conversations. Mr. Sarnes initially said to Mr. Riley there had been blue-green residue found at Ravenswood. He subsequently repeated that Ravenswood believed they had discovered the source and it was not the sterilizer, it was the detergent. Another question was asked about whether the government was aware of the marketing. And I believe Defense Exhibits 38, 39, and Government Exhibit 236B all indicate the government was perfectly aware that they were continuing to market the device, and hence the warning letter. Judge Easterbrook, you had asked about the instructions, and I neglected to invite the court's attention to page 164, where the statement appears, the manufacturer is not permitted to promote uses for a device that have not been cleared by the FDA. Mr. Ferguson responds by saying, but they were told that they had to find fraud or deceit. Well, that's only part of what they were told. On page 166, they were told also that it could be mere overreaching. That's the word that the jury was given, not that there had to be fraud. There could be fraud, deceit, or overreaching. I'd like to touch on the 404B.
Is overreaching defined?
No, it's never defined, Your Honor. And I think one could, if I were a juror, I would conclude that once you're told that they're not permitted to engage in off-label marketing, that is overreaching. On the 404B issue, This is a case where the government disavowed any desire to rely upon the inextricably related. It told the judge it wasn't relying on 404B. It was part of the conspiracy. And, in fact, it's a situation like the Beasley case, Judge Easterbrook's opinion there, where there were no instructions. The jury was given no guidance whatsoever as to what to do with this information. If you look at the indictment, which was the theory that was advocated below, it didn't and couldn't allege that the testing, which was 4 years before the indictment, was a part of the conspiracy. And the reason I say it couldn't was because even though the test results were in massive discovery that had been produced, it wasn't until the government interviewed a Dr. Janovic in November of 2005, shortly before the trial, that the light went off and it now understood the significance of the testing which predated the conspiracy by 4 years. So not only isn't it in the indictment, it couldn't have been in the indictment based upon the theory espoused below. And so it's a case where the defendants had no grand jury return an indictment containing the most poisonous of all the testimony, and that is that this device failed to clear polio, failed to clear hepatitis, herpes, other serious diseases. And whatever the jury may have been told about the sterilizer or marketing, that was the most poisonous of the evidence that you could imagine, and it was something that the grand jury never charged. We would ask the court to reverse the conviction unless there are any other questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.